Guess what day it is? It's D-Day, as in the Democratic primaries come to a conclusion day. And during our time together, we'll have a chance to talk about it. Is it really the end or just the end of the beginning? Center for American Progress Action Fund Vice President Daniela Gibbs Leger was at this weekend's DNC committee meeting determining the fate of Michigan and Florida. She'll help us understand what happened. The two states voting today have Native American populations that could make a difference in the outcome of the primaries. Keith Harper, former head of the D.C. Office of the Native American Rights Fund, will talk to us about the Native American community and their power in 2008. And we'll spend a few minutes speaking with Senator Tom Daschle, who hails from South Dakota and was the former minority and majority leader in the Senate. He'll give us the inside story on today's primary and so much more. You're listening to The Progressive Beat with Melody Barnes, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And now I'm really pleased to have on The Progressive Beat Senator Tom Daschle. I'm sure it's a surprise to no one that he needs no introduction. He's a Democrat from South Dakota who served in the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, where he was majority and minority leader. Now, Senator Daschle serves as a distinguished senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He's an advisor at the law firm of Austin and Byrd, and he's a visiting professor at Georgetown University. Welcome, Senator Daschle.
Thank you, Melody. Good to be with you.
Well, today is an exciting day for you for many reasons. One, we are wrapping up the Democratic primaries. And two, one of the final primaries is in South Dakota. Can you tell us what's driving voters to the polls in South Dakota?
Well, I think there's a tremendous amount of excitement. South Dakotans and Montanans both are kind of excited about the thought that they have the last word with regard to primaries. We've been through contests now in all 50 states in either caucuses or primaries, and South Dakota's one of the last ones. So they've had a good deal of attention these last 10 days or 2 weeks.
And right, which must be unusual.
They kind of like it. It's unusual.
Exactly. Something they could get used to in South Dakota.
Exactly. Yeah, we haven't seen this for a long time.
And who is going to the polls? Tell us more for listeners who have never been to South Dakota, which is an incredible state. What does the demography of the state look like? Who's voting today?
Well, you know, the demographics are changing somewhat. I think you've seen a lot of young people who, for the first time, are really getting involved politically. That's happening all over the country, but it's also happened in South Dakota. We're getting reports of tremendous new youth vote and student vote all over the country, and South Dakota in particular, and that's very exciting. The other thing that's exciting to me is the Native American vote. We have a large Native American population. It's about 7% of our state population-wise, and we expect to see a very high turnout among Native American voters this week.
Well, it's interesting. We are going to be talking to Keith Harper later in today's show, and he was the head of the Native American Rights Fund in Washington, D.C. We were talking to him about the fact that the Native American community actually can be a big swing community for elected officials in South Dakota and throughout the Mountain West.
Well, Keith is exactly right, and you're lucky to have such a good guest. He's a personal friend of mine, and I can't say enough about the leadership he's shown. But he's absolutely right. Native Americans have actually made the difference in a number of very key elections over the course of the last 10 or 15 years, all over the country, but especially in South Dakota.
And one of the other things that I think is interesting, there's the large Native American vote. Also, this issue around the working class vote. 88% of the population in South Dakota is white. And as you said, there's also a large Native American population. About half the population is female. And yet, we're seeing that Senator Obama seems to have a pretty large lead going into today's primary. There still exists this mantra about Senator Obama not being able to capture the working class vote. Why do you think that characterization is still sticking? Why is that out there?
Well, I think really for a couple of reasons. First of all, Hillary Clinton has done a very good job of talking to the issues. Bill Clinton in the 1990s was responsible for creating 22 million new jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And really advocating for working families in so many ways. And I think that was a legacy of the Clinton administration that has held over and been a big factor. But that certainly doesn't mean they're voting against Barack Obama. They're voting in part because they have a great deal of admiration for the Clintons. But secondly, I think part of the perception is just wrong. Barack Obama has done extremely well in many states where blue-collar voters have made a big difference, Virginia, Wisconsin, Missouri, Minnesota. I mean, so we feel very good, and we think as we go into the general election, given the choice between a Barack Obama and a John McCain, people aren't going to have any trouble at all making the choice and coming to the conclusion that Barack Obama represents working families very well.
And I'm hoping that we'll actually start to shift the terminology, that we will be more specific and more precise in what we're talking about, to recognize the fact that, you know, it isn't cut and dried. It isn't, you know, white versus African-American, working class versus other parts of the population, that we'll start to talk really about who's voting this year.
Well, that's a very good point. You know, that you were asking about demographics earlier. The demographics of this election are going to be vastly different than demographics we've seen in a long time. And I think that we have to be very careful about pigeonholing or stereotyping and coming to conclusions based on old stereotypes. And
exactly.
That's certainly going to be the case this year.
Well, I want to remind everyone that I'm speaking to Senator Tom Daschle, who represented South Dakota both in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and he's with us on the Progressive Beat broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Senator, I want to turn back the clock just a couple of days to the DNC's meeting this past Saturday. And I know that there was a lot of conversation, there were strong feelings on both sides, there was an outcome reached that would allow the delegates from Michigan and Florida to be seated. And at the same time, there seemed to be some contentiousness there. I remember watching you masterfully bring the Democratic caucus together when you were in the U.S. Senate. Can you tell us what you think needs to happen to make sure that Democrats are unified going into the November election?
Well, I think that's going to be one of the single biggest challenges as we look to the next several weeks. It's going to be important that Senator Obama reach out to women in particular. You know, this is a real opportunity for women to support a candidate that for the first time in history could be making history in a very meaningful way. And the depth of feeling is very palpable, and I understand that. So we have to understand the extraordinary sense of ownership and the extraordinary pride that women had in a Hillary Clinton campaign. And I think that has to be recognized, and we have to deal with it. And we have to reach out and begin to work to try to bring women who were very committed to Senator Clinton's campaign into ours as well. I think beyond that, it's important for us to go to certain parts of labor who are very engaged in the Clinton campaign and, mm-hmm. and other groups. But I think it started with last weekend. I think Barack Obama and the campaign made a very magnanimous decision to go the extra mile to work out these compromises in both Michigan and Florida. They did so not to everybody's satisfaction, but I think by anybody's standard, it was fair.
Well, I think that's often what they call a compromise when both sides feel like they've given up a little bit. So.
Well, I think that's right. That's exactly right, and that's what happened last weekend.
And I can definitely appreciate what you said about the historic nature and appreciating that and understanding that, but being able to move forward. I know as an African-American woman, for me, I mean, this election is historic in so many different ways, but you don't have to divide yourself, part of yourself from the other part of yourself. We can recognize the history and the great strides that have been taken, but at the same time, still support progressive goals and ideals going into November.
That's exactly right. If we're successful at doing that, there's every reason to believe we're going to be successful in November.
Well, Senator Daschle, I just want to ask you one more question as you're wrapping up. What do you think the convention's going to look like when we get to August? I mean, it has the potential to be incredibly exciting.
Well, I think it does. I think in many ways it could be one of the most exciting in our lifetimes. Going to the demographics, just knowing how much history we're going to be making and knowing that there's a real chance we could be especially unified, we're certainly optimistic. You know, in past elections, we've had a right to be very concerned about our prospects, and we should be very concerned this time. But I also think we have a reason to be optimistic. I think the American people want to see change. They certainly recognize the the monumental change that could have come about as a result of the election of a Barack Obama. So I'm thrilled. I'm very, very excited, and I think it's going to be a fun convention to watch.
Well, Senator Daschle, I want to thank you so much for being on the Progressive Beat today. I hope you will join us at some other point to share your insights and your perspective and your wisdom. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Melody. Love to come back.
And now we're here with Daniela Gibbs Leger, who is Vice President for Communications at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And Daniela formerly was the Deputy Director of Communications at the Democratic National Convention. Daniela, welcome to the Progressive Beat.
Hi, Melody. It's great to be with you.
Daniela, you were in a place on Saturday that few dare to go, and we want to hear all about it. Daniela was at the Wardman Marriott in Washington, D.C., where the DNC finally had to deal with the fact that Florida and Michigan jumped the gun, held early primaries, and now had to figure out what to do with those delegates. Daniela, describe for us what happened in that room.
Do we have 2 hours? Well, first of all, when I walked up and I saw about 200 protesters outside, my first thought was, who are all these people who are here spending their Saturday, gorgeous Saturday?
It was a beautiful day in
DC. It was lovely. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm about to go sit in this meeting too, so I couldn't say too much. So that was a great scene setter for what was about to happen. You know, the meeting was almost 12 hours long. There was a lot of protests, a lot of shouting going on in the room, a lot of really crazy comments that I heard throughout the day.
And were there more Hillary supporters, more Obama supporters, equally mixed? And what about the actual members of the committee?
I think in the audience, it was definitely more Hillary supporters. There was kind of a compact group of Obama supporters, but I would say probably 70% of the audience was Hillary supporters, and they were loud. The committee itself was made up. She had more supporters on the committee. I don't remember the exact breakdown. And then there are about five or six who were neutral or uncommitted.
And we all now know what happened at the end of the day. They agreed to seat both of the delegations, mm-hmm. but their votes count for about half. But all the anger seems to be circulating around the Michigan deal and the fact that they even they even gave Obama some of the delegates from Michigan, considering the fact that his name wasn't on the ballot. But now that that deal's been cut, mm-hmm. what do you think is going to happen next? Because it sounds to me like Senator Clinton is not waving the white flag of surrender quite yet.
Not at all. Not judging from her speech in Puerto Rico yesterday, it was, we are going on and we're continuing. And she sent out an email to supporters last night saying the same thing. You know, I don't know what's going on inside of that camp. And I guess the only people who really know what's going to happen is Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, Chelsea Clinton, and maybe Harold Ickes.
Who sounded like he had an interesting day on Saturday.
No, he certainly did. Kudos to Rob Wexler for putting him in his place. I think that, you know, maybe they want to keep their supporters engaged through the rest of this process. So she wasn't going to come out yesterday and say, all right, you know what? They divided Michigan and Florida. I have no numerical way of winning this. I'm going to give up.
So do you think this was just a show to get us through today's primaries in South Dakota and Montana? Or do you think that she really wants to take this to the Credentials Committee, take this to the convention?
I can't believe that she would want to do that, because what is the best outcome that's going to happen? Okay, so they maybe give back the four delegates from Michigan that they feel were taken from them, or they maybe give them 100% vote. I don't even think that would overturn Obama's delegate count. So I don't know what purpose her going through the Credentials Committee would do other than to tear the party apart and make Obama a weaker candidate. So,
but she seems to be making the argument that this is about the popular vote. And if you count all the popular vote and not necessarily what's happened in the caucuses, then that's her signal to the public, to the DNC, to the convention, that she's actually the one who could win the election in November.
Right. Well, that's kind of like living in, you know, la-la land. Because the last time I checked, the way the Democrats get their nominee is through delegates. I mean, she is on record as saying it's delegates. Harold Ickes, Mark Penn, it's delegates, delegates, delegates.
Well, then do you think it's about something? I've been thinking about this, that, you know, things aren't always as they seem to be, that this is really about negotiating power for the convention, you know, where she speaks, the timing of her speech. Mm-hmm. You know, also, there's a lot of debt that the Clinton campaign has amassed, and there's a history of the winning campaign actually taking on the losing campaign's mm-hmm. debt. Is this a part of those negotiations?
I think that could be it. I think it could be she wants to get a primetime speaking role. Mm. Her husband wants to get a primetime speaking role. And she's got about, what, $11 million in campaign debt that she needs to pay off. So that could be part of it.
Well, but while she's doing that, though, I mean, we've all seen and heard and, you know, in talking to you over the course of the weekend, there was the hissing and the booing and yelling and the jeering that was in the room, and not only in the room, but outside the room at the same time. So there's this feeling of anger between the two camps, whether or not it's real between the candidates.
Right.
And how do you think she and Senator Obama go about repairing that?
Well, I think the onus is going to be on her. If Senator Obama, we believe he will be the nominee, it's going to have to be her. She's going to have to talk to her supporters, much like Howard Dean did. And I don't know if you heard him give his opening remarks on Saturday. You know, he talked about how he was so angry he didn't want to do anything for the Democratic Party. And Al Gore reminded him, yeah, this isn't about you,
You're
Howard.
You're the chairman, buddy.
You know? So I think that it's up to her. It depends on how much she goes out and tells her supporters, hey, look, you know what? I really wanted to be president. It didn't work out this time, but we've got to support Barack Obama because having John McCain as our president is not an option. So if she goes out and campaigns vigorously for him and really has an honest conversation with her voters like that, I think that, you know, there may be some people who will vote for McCain. You know, can't stop that. But
right.
I think the 30, 40, 50 people, percent of people in these exit polls who say they won't vote for Obama, I think that'll subside. But she's really got to make the difference.
Well, I want to remind everyone that we are here with Daniela Gibbs Leger, who's VP of Communications at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And you're listening to The Progressive Beat. Daniela, today they are voting in South Dakota and Montana. And it's interesting. Barack has a big lead in both of those states. Mm-hmm. Senator Clinton, as we know, won in Puerto Rico over the weekend. But part of the rhetoric throughout this campaign, you know, after Pennsylvania, after Kentucky, after Ohio, has been that that working class voters won't support Obama.
Right.
Last time I checked, South Dakota had about 88% of a white population, but they seem to be supporting him. Why does that mantra still stick?
You know, I really don't know. And I finally have heard some people, some pundits talking about this and kind of beating back this false notion. In Wisconsin, in Oregon, he won white working class voters. He won voters who, you know, are middle class. He won voters who didn't have college education. So if they want to be accurate, maybe they can say he does have a problem with white working class voters in Appalachia or in, you know, some rural parts of Pennsylvania and Ohio. But to make this broad generalization, it's wrong.
Yeah, it's like we're using labels to use labels, but they don't fit. They don't make sense for the reality. And I have to say, you know, as an African-American African-American woman, that the idea that African-Americans aren't working class people is also pretty frustrating.
Right. And so when Senator Clinton said, you know, hardworking Americans, white Americans, I was like, hey, I work hard.
Just ask our boss.
Exactly.
Oh, gosh. So hopefully we'll start to work on turning the rhetoric around. We actually have labels. Well, that we're not using labels unless they're necessary, but we're actually using terminology and having a conversation about the reality.
Right, and yeah, talking about stuff that's accurate.
Well, Daniela, I want to thank you so much for being on the Progressive Beat today.
It's been great to be with you.
Thank you so much, and I hope you'll come back another time.
Anytime.
And here's a wedding planning tip. When you're planning the guest list for your reception, make sure to tell the Democratic National Convention they are not invited. Danielle DeBouchanane and Matt Rogers did not, and look what happened to them. Arriving at the Marriott Wardman in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, the happy couple was met by protesters outside the meeting where the DNC was trying to figure out what to do about Michigan and Florida. Apparently, the bride was quizzed in the ladies' room by those who wanted to know if she supported Obama or Clinton. It would seem as though wearing a wedding dress would help you avoid that. But luckily, the newlyweds were good-natured, and they said they embraced the scene. And later, DNC Chair Howard Dean sent a platter of food and a bottle of champagne to their room. Speaking of food, they say you are what you eat. But do we eat the way we vote? Some political strategists think so. Stuffed crust pizza, McCain voter. Fig Newton lover, Clinton. Olive oil user, Obama. Yes, I'm serious. According to those who study so-called micro-targeting, what you buy and the way you spend your time signals how you will cast your vote. Red wine and Fiji water signals a Republican vote. Vodka and Sprite are for Democrats. Can you guess who loves Chick-fil-A and who eats Popeye's fried chicken? The next time you flip open your J. Crew catalog or run into a Chipotle, remember, the campaigns are watching you. Let's get another perspective on the South Dakota and Montana primaries taking place today. I am pleased to have Keith Harper on the Progressive Beat. Keith is a partner at Kilpatrick and Stockton, and he has an extensive Native American practice there, but he was also senior staff attorney and head of the D.C. office of the Native American Rights Fund. Keith is also a member of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Keith, welcome to the Progressive Beat.
Thanks for having me.
Keith, looking at the primaries and just looking at what's taking place in the Mountain West in general, are you surprised by all the attention that the Native American community is getting this year?
No. I think that when you're trying to compete in states like Montana or South Dakota or the Southwest, the Indian vote has become a critical piece of the electorate. I think there are numerous examples, particularly out in the West, where senators have been put in office and others are in office because of the Native vote. You know, Senator John Tester had a huge Native turnout, and he's a senator today. Senator Tim Johnson won by some 530 votes, and it's attributable largely to the very high turnout in some of the western reservation communities in South Dakota. So I think the smarter politician understands that galvanizing the Native vote in those places is a key part of their strategy.
But I think that most people are probably surprised by that. I mean, nationally, the Native vote is about 2%. And people, even though Native Americans are clearly Native Americans, I mean, they're critical to our history and to our democracy, but most people aren't paying attention. But clearly, Senator Clinton and Senator McCain and Senator Obama are. They've been to some of the states that you've mentioned numerous times.
Absolutely. Melody, you make an extraordinarily important point. And the fact is that, largely in official Washington, Native people are invisible, partly for a lot of historical reasons, but also because they haven't been part of important electoral decision-making. One, they've been disenfranchised largely. Two, they're in alienated rural communities. There's a lot of reasons for it, but I think they've largely been invisible both on the policy-making and the political realm. But what I think you're seeing in the West is sort of a increased recognition of the importance of Native people at the polls.
Well, but I think it goes to what you say. A smart politician realizes that. I mean, when the Native vote constitutes, 10% of the vote in New Mexico?
Absolutely.
And New Mexico this year is one of the key big swing states.
Absolutely. And to the extent that, Wisconsin is another one where not quite as high as New Mexico, but clearly a battleground state, the Native vote is critical. And a lot of these places, the electorate is so closely divided that if you can get the Native community to break largely in your direction, that can really make a fundamental difference. And I think we've seen that in a number of states. Washington State, for example, some years ago, about six or eight years ago, Slade Gordon lost his seat largely due to an extraordinary turnout from the Native vote because of his alienation of that community based on his policies in the Senate.
And that is also interesting to me because Senator McCain, even though the Native vote often, in many states anyway, tends to break Democratic, Senator McCain was the past chair of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee.
Absolutely.
So he's got a relationship with the Native American community. Could that make it tight, more interesting this year?
Well, I think that he's hoping so.
really, be right.
but I think he's got some challenges. The last 2 years of his chairmanship, his most recent chairmanship of the Indian Affairs Committee, there were huge issues before him: the trust mismanagement issue, the Indian health care issue, the violence on Indian reservations, all education underfunding, all of these issues that he could have dealt with. He dealt with none of them. And instead, he concentrated on a lobbyist scandal called Jack Abramoff in order to bolster his presidential bid. And so I think in Indian country, it's largely seen as he had an opportunity to do the right thing, but didn't actually take that opportunity to affect positive change in people's lives out in Indian country.
Well, and, you know, Keith, just in wrapping up, I think one of the things, and you and I have talked about this before, that's really critical is for the Indian and Native American community is the fact that people coming to you aren't coming for the first time at the last minute, that they really know who you are.
Yeah. And I think that Senator Obama's early efforts in that way, I mean, you are absolutely correct that Senator McCain has a long-standing relationship with Indian country. But that, I think that cuts both ways, given what the record is. With Senator Obama, I think that even though he's an Illinois senator so with no federally recognized tribes in his state, he made a concerted effort early on to get out there, meet with tribal leaders, and virtually every stop he's made out west, every state, Idaho, Washington, the Southwest, Montana, as you mentioned, in South Dakota, he's met with tribal leaders.
And that's really, that's going to make this an incredibly interesting November.
Absolutely.
Well, Keith Harper, thank you so much for being on the Progressive Beat. I hope you'll join us again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And now, everyone, we can take a big, deep breath. The Democratic primaries are finally over, and we can see what happens when the dust clears. Will Senator Clinton challenge the results of the DNC committee meeting? Also pay attention to what happens on the Senate floor with the climate change bill. Will those who like it hot, as in the earth, actually try to muzzle the bill and bring it down? Or will we have a real opportunity to debate global warming and make an opportunity and take steps for progressive change? Thanks so much for listening to The Progressive Beat, broadcast live from the Center for American Progress Action Fund.